This is 5 o'clock shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network, originating at WBAI. I'm Robert Knight in New York, and quite happy to bring on board today Arne Gundersen, nuclear engineer, expert witness, former plant operator, and an analyst who has been prescient about the critical conditions at Fukushima, as well as very specific about the dangers of many types of reactors here in the United States. Welcome back to the shadow, Arne.
Hi, thanks for having me.
For those joining us, give folks a bit of your background.
Well, I'm older than dirt. I've been in the nuclear industry for 39 years and was a senior VP at a nuclear company, became a whistleblower, and that was in 1990. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission botched the inspection and was taking bribes from my employer, and the rest is history. I've molded my life to be a consultant now, and I'm very much enjoying working with Fairwinds and identifying nuclear issues.
Arne, we're going to discuss the international, national, regional issues of nuclear operations and safety, or the lack thereof in many cases. But I'm sure that our listeners in the northeastern metropolitan area are quite interested to know that you are about to testify in regard to the operation of the Indian Point nuclear facility in Buchanan, New York. What is the venue, and what do you intend to do?
Well, there are hearings that have been going on and will continue to go on up in Albany. And these are related to state issues, not Nuclear Regulatory Commission issues. So it's in front of a New York State judge, and I have been retained by Riverkeeper. And there are other experts that have been retained by the state of New York and Clearwater and other organizations as well. The areas I've been involved in have been the cooling tower issue, and this week I'll be testifying on the tritium and strontium that's been leaking into the Hudson River, and ways to eliminate that from occurring.
Tritium, that's heavy water. Strontium, that's a byproduct of fission. How do these things get in the river?
Well, what happened was, in the last 10 years, large plumes, underground plumes of tritium and strontium were discovered at the Indian Point site. The nuclear fuel pool on Unit 1 was discovered to be leaking, and then the nuclear fuel pool on Unit 2 was discovered to be leaking. And over quite a few years, a large amount of tritium and especially a bigger concern of strontium and cesium and other elements have leaked into the groundwater. And it's moving. I guess the good news is for the Buchanan people is that it's moving off-site to the west, i.e. it's moving into the Hudson River. It doesn't appear to be moving either north or south onto any of the adjacent property. The groundwater flow takes the radioactive leakage and gradually pushes it into the Hudson River.
So there is a sparkling dust or something outside the plant.
Well, there's been many leaks. It's not just the fuel pool leak, and it's not just the there's been numerous leaks over the years. But the one I found illustrative and interesting was the plant releases radioactive gases that then get trapped in the haze along the river, and they fall like rain. And one of the drains on site was filled with radioactive tritium, and it overflowed, ran down a street on site and directly into the Hudson River. There have been other underground pipes that have leaked as well. But the NRC's position on this is interesting. They accept the fact that it's okay if Indian Point simply monitors these releases and doesn't do anything about them. So they've put in a series of monitoring wells, and as they find leaks, they attempt to figure out where they came from and they attempt to plug them. But the contamination in the ground is just allowed to wash out into the Hudson River over time.
Arnie, what about the storage problem at Indian Point? We know that, for instance, at Fukushima, the spent fuel pool is one of the major ongoing hazards. The situation is somewhat different at Indian Point, but is storage an issue?
Actually, the fuel pools are remarkably similar to Fukushima. They're not as high up in the air, but they essentially have a large amount of nuclear fuel that's been collected over many years. And as the pools get close to full, the Entergy takes some of the fuel and puts it into dry casks, but not much. And so essentially we have two nuclear fuel pools, Unit 2 and Unit 3, that are chock-a-block full of spent nuclear fuel, 30-plus years of nuclear fuel in these pools. The pools are cooled, just like at Fukushima, by pumps that suck water out of the river and run that water through a heat exchanger and back out to the river. So there's really no difference in the mechanism for cooling the plant. Now, at Fukushima, of course, the pumps lost electricity, and they also lost the cooling water. So there's a double strike at Fukushima, and it's called station blackout. The same thing would occur at Indian Point. If there were a station blackout, the fuel pool would get warmer and warmer, and over a period of perhaps a day or two, it could begin to boil. So the question is, how long do you assume that a station blackout will occur? And, of course, no one ever assumes it goes a day or two. The longest the NRC requires that you assume a station blackout is 8 hours. If you assume it lasts 8 hours, then you never boil the water.
Arnie, the issue of storage and the accumulation of it at Indian Point, some of it is cask storage, and yet there is also the fuel pool. Is cask storage any safer? And beyond that, is there a problem of accumulated radioactive fuel mass? Do they just keep building more casks, or does it eventually have to be transported somewhere, and are there problems with that?
Well, there's no place to transport it. So as long as the plant continues to run, they'll continue to generate more radiation, which means they'll continue to buy more fuel casks to put it into. They are definitely safer than the wet storage inside the fuel pool. Fukushima had had dry cask storage, and the dry cask survived just fine. So why don't we have dry cask storage? The reason is it's more expensive than letting it sit in the pool, but it's riskier. So the NRC's made the trade-off not to force the owners to spend the money, and they push the risk onto the public. And I don't think that's right. I think the right thing to do would be to get as much fuel out of the fuel pools and into dry cask storage as possible. But there's no place to ship it, so it would remain on site, but just in a safer vehicle, a safer container, than sitting in a spent fuel pool.
One other point that you raise, Arnie Gunderson, that is less discussed in regard to Indian Point is the issue of cooling towers. I myself am not completely familiar with the issue of the cooling towers at Indian Point.
Well, it's actually most likely the deal breaker. The state and Riverkeeper want cooling towers installed, and Entergy has said that it's going to take 15 or 20 years to build the cooling towers, and by that time the unit will be shut down. What happens is the plant it draws in 2 billion gallons of water a day. That's with a B, gallons of water a day, and it heats it up 30 degrees, so any fish eggs that are in that water are fried, and any kind of larval fish are killed. So there's a significant ongoing mortality issue for fish in the Hudson River because of these two plants. So the position of Riverkeeper in the state of New York are that the best alternative is cooling towers. Now, Entergy does not want cooling towers, and what they're proposing, but cooling towers have been backfitted on other plants around the country, so it's not not new technology. What Entergy is proposing are called wedge wire screens, and they sort of look like a 20-foot long cigar that, instead of having solid sides, has screens on it. And there would be 150 or 160 of these cigars out in the Hudson River, and they would suck the water through these cigars, and the screen would keep the larval fish and the fish eggs from being pulled through the plant. Now, that's never been tried on a nuclear plant before.
Well, perhaps Rube Goldberg has not been contracted to do the design.
It's much less expensive. I think that's the, Entergy's position is that they're not going to spend money on those cooling towers, and they would prefer to shut the plant down instead. There was a similar problem at down in New Jersey at Oyster Creek, where Exelon owned that plant, and the state said, you're killing Barnegat Bay, we need a cooling tower. And the compromise position was that instead of running for 20 years, Oyster Creek would run for 10 and then shut down. But in those 10 years, it would not put in a cooling tower. With the power market where it is, with very low cost gas power coming in from lots of different sources, a lot of these large nukes are no longer the low cost producer, and it's difficult for them to have a capital expense like a cooling tower.
We're speaking with Arne Gundersen, and Arne, I'm sure many New Yorkers of concern are quite happy that you'll be taking part in these Albany hearings next week. Give our listeners details about how they may follow these deliberations.
I wish I knew. I'm working for, contracted with Riverkeeper. And they do
Riverkeeper.org.
Yes, they do have on their site some vehicles to keep in touch with the proceedings. I don't believe that there's a daily live feed or a daily summary of what goes on, though. And it has not been well covered in the press either. So it's almost like we're going to wait for the outcome and then have one day of publicity, when in fact there's an awful lot of useful information that comes out of the hearings.
Our guest is Arne Gundersen of Fairwinds Associates. And Arne, our discussions and the most recent report that you've featured on Fairwinds Associates is about hotspots that are being discovered in the oddest places, which brings to mind my question for you. In the release of radioactivity, in the event of nuclear accidents, power plant disasters and failures, is there even such a thing as a genuinely local nuclear event?
No. I mean, the radiation doesn't stop at a city boundary, let alone a national boundary or internationally. What we found, by the way, we posted a brand new video today on a different topic. So if your readers, if your listeners go back to the Fairwinds site, there's a new video today on a different topic. But the video immediately before that addresses these hot particles. What we found was that obviously Japan is a mess, to use a highly technical term. But we also found in the Cascades, that's on the Pacific Northwest, hot spots of hot particles that in Seattle, and local contamination throughout the Cascades on the order of 100 disintegrations per second in about 2 pounds of dirt. So it's nowhere near as bad as Japan, but it's not a personal health risk in the United States. We can't run and we can't hide, but the radiation is going to cause cancers on a statistical basis. There's not much that an individual can do If you're in the Cascades, perhaps you need to wash your shoes and watch your vegetables and things like that. But nationally, the radiation has now spread out to the point where all of us are going to get some, and some of us are going to get a cancer as a result. But who that person is not going to be something that a scientist can ever identify. In Japan, it's a different story. In Japan, we're going to see an increase of cancer rates by 20 or 30%, which is and perhaps even higher in Fukushima Prefecture. What we found was that we got volunteers to mail us air filters from their cars, and we had Fukushima Prefecture air filters in Tokyo and scattered throughout all of Japan. Now, this was done by two groups. It was done by Fairwinds, my wife's company, and then also it was done by Safecast, which is a group of citizen scientists in Japan. We collected about 5 dozen air filters and sent them to Massachusetts, where there's a lab at Worcester-Poly run by a guy named Marco Kaltofen. And he would lay the air filter out on X-ray film, put them into a safe, and then about a week later take them out, and the radiation will burn holes in the X-ray film. Well, the Fukushima air filters were so contaminated, we couldn't wait a week because they had so many burn holes, you lost track of all the radiation. So we had to change the procedure and keep them in for a day or two. Those pictures are up on the website where you can see a Seattle air filter, which is essentially clean, and a Tokyo air filter, which has quite a few hot particles. And then worst of all is the Fukushima Prefecture air filters. And, somebody was driving that car while it was collecting this, and your lungs are just as effective an air filter as your car. So there should be grave concern in Japan, but I'm afraid that TEPCO, Tokyo Electric, and the Japanese government are deliberately downplaying the significance of this.
You make the distinction, Arnie, between an issue of personal health and public health in regard to radiation exposure, and I'm wondering if we have had enough time pass to already see implications for the Japanese health system. Would it be unreasonable to expect that there will be increased stillbirths, that there will be less survivability in delicate medical conditions and so on?
There should be, but there's not a lot of data coming out of Japan yet. And I'm not sure if it's just because the data is slow to arrive, or whether because the Japanese and the Japanese doctors have chosen not to publicize it. There's some anecdotal evidence of damage already, but as far as official reports go, I have not seen any yet.
How do you clean up an entire countryside? There was a 10-mile evacuation. Officials are only slowly and reluctantly admitting the exponentially larger exposures than they officially have admitted. And those numbers keep growing day by day. Tokyo, places that would not be obvious from dominant wind patterns, have been highly struck with this radioactive debris in the wind, not to mention in the Pacific Ocean. How bad is it on both the land and the ocean?
Yeah, well, that's a great question. How do you clean up a country? Before I get to there, they've just discovered that 80% of the radiation went into the Pacific. Now, that's good, because it didn't. If the wind had been blowing the other way, it would have destroyed Japan as a nation. It would have cut Japan in half, north to south. So it was good that the wind blew out to sea for the people of Japan, but it's really not very good for the Pacific Ocean, that's for sure. But how do you do it is, first you have to admit the severity of the problem, and then admit it's going to cost a lot of money. Tokyo Electric is saying they're going to clean this thing up for something on the order of 15 billion U.S. I won't talk in yen, because they've got a lot more zeros than we do, but something on the order of $15 billion. And, you know, I used to do decommissioning of power plants for a living. And I think the Fukushima site alone, not the state, just the site, is going to be something like $50 billion. And then the land mass that's most contaminated is probably going to be another $150 billion after that. So we're looking at $200 billion. And right now there's a question of who's going to pay for that. It looks like the Japanese government is trying to prop up TEPCO, trying not to force them into bankruptcy. But I think the right thing to do would be to sell them, to let TEPCO be sold and use the cash, because it does have a lot of other assets, use that cash to compensate victims and to clean up. Even when that's done, there will be, you know, perhaps another $100 billion that's going to have to come out of the Japanese government.
Arnie, because of BP in the Gulf of Mexico, I could no longer eat red snapper. Because of TEPCO in the Pacific, I can no longer enjoy ahi tuna. There's yet another water problem that I neglected to mention. I'm understanding that that radioactive water has leaked underneath the facilities and possibly encroached upon the water table that serves the nearby population. Have you heard anything like that?
Yes. By the way, you can. I'm advising my friends to eat tuna and salmon this year, because I think the radiation will work its way up the food chain, and by next year it will be something that questionable. But you're right, the floors cracked during the earthquake. The Fukushima site dropped by 18 inches. The land just dropped 18 inches as a result of the earthquake. That was how severe it is. And when land does that, obviously the foundation cracks, and groundwater is coming in and radiation is going out into the soil. Now, what TEPCO is proposing is they're building a berm, a dike, on the ocean side to prevent that radiation from moving into the ocean. But they're not building it on the land side. One of the proposals out, and I think part of the reason is they just don't have the money. They are undercapitalized and unable to do all the things they should be doing. One of the proposals on the land side of the power plant is to put in wells that will pull that water out of the ground and treat it so that it doesn't continue to move inland. If it grows inland, Robert, I think we're looking at, you know, 100 years where people will not be able to use that groundwater.
Our guest is Arnie Gunderson of Fairwinds Associates. And Arnie, you have, with your prodigious work, often made the point that the engineering liability of the design of the Fukushima plants, or some of them, is one that Americans face as a risk every day throughout the country. Can you speak to the design failures or hazards that are still operating every day here?
Yeah, we have 23 reactors that are identical to Fukushima, of the 104 that are in the country. So about a little more than 20% of our reactors are identical to Fukushima. And I was an expert in a group of citizens petitioned the Nuclear Regulatory Commission to shut these down, including two engineers, me and a gentleman named Dale Breidenbaugh. Dale left General Electric back in 1976 because he recognized the problems in the Mark I design. So these Mark I reactors have, there's a long legacy of problems there. So a group of citizens has petitioned the NRC to shut those down. I don't think the NRC will ever do that. I think they may, over the next 3 or 4 years, insist on safety changes that will make some of those plants uneconomical. But the NRC will not say, this plant is unsafe. They'll say, this plant needs these modifications. And the owners will then say, we can't afford those modifications. And eventually, in 3 to 5 years, I suspect some of these will be shut down, but not all of them.
THX 1138. You also have something to say about what the industry is proclaiming to be the next sliced bread, the new reactor design basis of the AP1000. Do you find anything wrong with that?
Well, it dates back to Fukushima. I had some problems with the AP1000 design before Fukushima, and it had to do with the containment. And I was told by the NRC, in no uncertain terms, there is zero probability that the containment will fail. And this was last summer. And of course, we had Fukushima, where three containments failed in 3 days, and yet the NRC still hasn't changed its mentality. For these new reactors, they're saying it's zero probability that the containment will fail. Well, what happens on this new design is they've got an enormous water tower on the roof. They've got 6 million pounds of water up on the roof of this containment. And the theory is that after an accident, they can turn some valves on and sprinkle the water down over the containment to keep it cool. Well, Fukushima had what's called the loss of the ultimate heat sink. The ability to cool the plant failed. And the NRC is just now beginning to realize this, despite the fact that I said it on CNN back in March. And this loss of the ultimate heat sink applies to the AP1000 design as well. I could come up with about half a dozen ways that tank at the top could either fail or become plugged. And in either case, the ability of that tank to then cool the containment won't exist, and then we'll have a Fukushima-type event with the AP1000. So I've asked the NRC as part of something called the AP1000 Oversight Group, which is a group of NGOs, non-governmental organizations in the Southeast, to hold up on licensing the AP1000 and spend the next half year trying to look at what happened at Fukushima and apply those lessons to the AP1000. The NRC doesn't seem to want to do that. They want to license this plant with loan guarantees and get a couple of them built, like, right now.
And we know from the WikiLeaks cables that the State Department has put full force behind strong-arming governments around the world to give favorable terms to the manufacturers of the AP1000, so it does appear to be as much a financial issue as it is one of rationality, safety, or efficiency. Our guest is Arne Gundersen of Fairwinds Associates, and this is really an enlightening encounter because we're getting to catch up on so many things that have been developing beneath most public notice and most commercial coverage. And in the 3 minutes or so that we have remaining, Arne, I open the floor to you to apprise our intelligent listeners as to how to be more aware or protect themselves against these hazards.
I am advising our friends not to buy food from Japan, even if there's a claim that, you know, it's passed underneath the radiation detector and there's not much radioactivity. You know, I think for a year or two, it's just a prudent thing to do. You know, on the East Coast, that's really about all we can do. There's going to be a little bit of cesium in all our foods. I mean, my friend's garden showed up with a little bit of cesium. It's everywhere, and it's going to ultimately get in very low concentrations into our food. Not true in the Cascades. There's other things we should be doing there. But really, I think the key now, my biggest concern is what's coming in through the ocean. And your comment about tuna is certainly appropriate. I think we really need to push the government to inspect the fish, especially these top of the food chain fish, which will accumulate cesium and strontium and things like that. Maybe not now, but certainly starting next year. You know, the salmon and the tuna and these large top of the food chain animals. That's probably the most likely source for you and I on the East Coast to pick up a relatively high concentration of radiation would be starting about next year in the fish. The government doesn't want to do that, and they just, I think what's going to take is a shipload of tuna that sets off a radiation alarm in a port or something like that to get people's attention. But the right thing to do would be to monitor the fish and make sure that the concentrations are extraordinarily low.
Arne Gundersen, thank you so much for being with us today on 5 o'clock Shadow. I hasten to point out to our listeners that there's infinitely more detail and specificity and utility at the website, and it's spelled FAIREWINDS.com, fairwinds.com. And the website is a revelation, and it's maintained by reader support, much as we here are maintained by listener support. And Fairwinds is a 501c3. It's a nonprofit organization, and we certainly hope that our listeners will support your work at the website, and that you will shine brightly next week in Albany on Indian Point.
Well, thank you very much, and I'll keep you informed via emails on a daily basis about how it went.
Well, we'll share that with our listeners. Thank you once again. Arne Gundersen, nuclear expert, former plant operator of Fairwinds Associates, fairwinds.com. This is 5 o'clock Shadow. Robert Knight here on the Pacific Radio Network.